I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A crowd of well-wishers and hospital employees sent Senator Ted Kennedy on his way as he left Boston's Massachusetts General Hospital this morning, traveling by car to his home on Cape Cod a couple of hours away. Kennedy walked on his own, gave a thumbs up to the crowd. He was surrounded by family, including his wife, Vicky, his children, his niece, Caroline Kennedy Schlossberg, and the family dogs. The diagnosis of a malignant glioma in his left parietal lobe, the area of the brain that helps govern sensation, movement, and language, stunned Kennedy supporters. About 9,000 Americans are diagnosed with this form of brain cancer annually. About half of them die within a year. Kennedy has been in office 46 years. Here in Boston, it was easy to find people like this young man going into last night's Red Sox game who felt a personal connection.
Growing up in Brooklyn, the Kennedys were always a big part of our lives. My mom used to work in his campaign when I was a kid, and I've followed Ted throughout his career, and I actually came back from Europe just to vote for him during that Senate campaign with Mitt Romney. So today's news is very, very sad, and I wish them nothing but the best and a speedy recovery, and I hope his family's doing well. They've dealt with enough in their lives, and I really hope he gets a full recovery.
We're going to take a look at the impact of Kennedy's illness on the Senate in a few minutes. But first, we're joined by veteran Boston Globe journalist and longtime Kennedy watcher Kevin Cullen. Kevin, Kennedy's wife, Vicky, wrote to friends that the senator, first of all, was driving her crazy because he wants to be in the Fugawi sailing race this weekend. Fugawi is in, well, you know, where the heck are we?
Yeah, that's true.
A big local race, an annual Kennedy tradition down in the Cape. But do you think that's possible, that he's going to be there this weekend?
I wouldn't count him out on anything, Robin. Teddy's a tough guy. I mean, they've faced adversity in this family, as you and all of your listeners know. But, you know, all I can say is Teddy is as tough as I've ever met.
Well, you know, people have been saying today he could have walked out the back of the hospital. He could have, you know, taken that wheelchair, as most people do when they leave a hospital, to a car pulled around back. He could have been helicoptered off the roof. He could have done anything he wanted. He walked out the front.
Absolutely. Well, that's it. I think that's Teddy all over. He might be going out, but he's going out the front door.
Well, you know, he's. We've been hearing on talk radio here in the Boston area, you know, people just really, first of all, weeping. Let's approach the people who just feel such a strong connection to Ted Kennedy. What do you think is behind that?
Well, I mean, we've all kind of vicariously lived the Kennedy experience. I mean, for lack of a better term, they are our royal family, for good and bad. And I think everybody kind of, you know, depending on how old you are, you can kind of measure your life's achievements or moments through Kennedy moments. I mean, you know, a lot of people define that one of their experiences, where were they when Jack was killed? Or where were you? I remember watching Ironsides with my dad when news came over that Bobby Kennedy was dead. So there's all these things that I think that they are a family that we've kind of lived vicariously through in the good times and the bad.
And he it had to become a father to so many other children after those assassinations. Then he also shepherded us through John Kennedy's funeral, all the other funerals of the next generation. But, we, you know, we hasten to say, he's also just hated. I've talked here about traveling west to conservative strongholds in Montana, Idaho. When they meet you, people in some of these, and here you're from Massachusetts, the first thing they say is Kennedy's state.
Yeah. But
is that...
I wrote a column the other day, Robin, and I received, you know, an awful lot of Kennedy haters, and they all brought up Chappaquiddick, you know, the blah, blah, blah. You know,
we're never going to
forgive him for that, but you know what? I don't think Teddy will ever forgive himself for that, too. But the other thing is, look at the quotes today. All the when you hear the right-wing people, you know, really upset and hate Ted Kennedy, who is more right-wing in the United States Senate than Orrin Hatch? And Orrin Hatch loves Teddy Kennedy. And he loves Teddy Kennedy because he knows Teddy Kennedy. It's very easy to hate people you don't know. And The reality is that Teddy Kennedy is liked by people on both sides of the aisle. That doesn't mean he isn't partisan. He's very partisan, but he's also human.
Well, you point out a real disconnect, because it's true. We were hearing from both Republicans and Democrats yesterday, you know, weepy reactions to the diagnosis. And I just want to color in, you mentioned Chappaquiddick, of course, the death of Mary Jo Kopechne and Kennedy and the car Kennedy was driving over the Chappaquiddick Bridge so many years ago. That's what people who dislike him mentioned. They also, you know, mention his liberal agenda, but it really is something. I mean, I've been in Wyoming and said to people, you know, I don't say, oh, I'm in Wyoming, Dick Cheney. People don't make that connection. But people make that connection between Ted Kennedy and Massachusetts and his agenda. Is that also part of his power, even if you hate him?
Well, yeah, and I guess the difference between Dick Cheney and Ted Kennedy is longevity. And also, you know, people describe him as the liberal lion. It's become this cliche. Teddy's a legislative lion. I mean, there's more laws in this state, in this country, that bear his hallmark. I mean, the guy has created legislation, and let's see who he's helped. I know, you know, we can stand here all day and say he killed Mary Jo Kopechne or led to her death. How many lives has he saved? How many lives has he made better? He has always stuck up for the most vulnerable in our society. And frankly, that ain't very fashionable anymore. It's certainly not very fashionable down in Washington these days. So people that, you know, hate Ted Kennedy, they should get over it and have a life. And if they really care that much about their fellow man, instead of hating Ted Kennedy, why don't they go out there and help their fellow man? I'm sick of it.
That's Kevin Cullen with the Boston Globe. Kevin, just one last question for you, because we know you're in touch with the family. Daughter Kara had her own bout with cancer. His son Ted lost a leg to cancer. Patrick, Congressman from Rhode Island, battled alcoholism. They also know how to approach this, but how are they doing?
Oh, I wouldn't pretend to know how they're doing, Robin, really. I just am not that close at that level. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, these are people, like I said, they've been there before. And this is a family that's had a lot of ups and downs, and this is another down. And they rally around each other. They turn in like a lot of families. It's just that this family, everything they do is in the spotlight. Everything's under the magnifying glass. But, you know, they'll go down to Hyannisport, they'll close ranks, and they'll do the best they can.
And by this weekend, they'll probably sail. That's Kevin Cullen, Boston Globe columnist. Kevin, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, Senator Kennedy is the second longest-serving member of the Senate behind West Virginia Democrat Robert Byrd, who broke down in tears yesterday on the news of Kennedy's diagnosis. But Kennedy's absence from Washington has already stalled some legislation. For more of that, we go to Christian Science Monitor senior congressional correspondent Gail Chadwick. Gail, we want to hear, you know, what's happening legislatively, but it was quite a moment yesterday when Byrd and others, and in fact, let's listen to a little bit of Democrat Robert Byrd reacting to the news of his friend's diagnosis.
Ted, my dear friend, I love you, and I miss you.
Gail, this has been quite a day.
Absolutely. You know, the news broke just as Republicans and Democrats were getting out of their caucus lunches, which is typically a moment when all guns are blazing on a partisan level. And instead, you had on the floor of the Senate, as you just heard, tears, tributes on both sides of the aisle, heartfelt, and prayer.
And Gail, tell us more about that, because Kevin was saying this as well. Kennedy is vilified by so many Americans, and yet in Washington, he is embraced by so many on the other side of the aisle.
Well, you have to also understand the Senate, and no one understood the Senate as well as Senator Kennedy did, not just its procedures, but he understood as well as anyone that's ever served there that the Senate is its people, and he really took the time to know people. Now, I had a sense of this even before yesterday, but I was stunned at some of the things that people were saying about him. Mitch McConnell, you know, the Republican Senate leader, you couldn't imagine a more implacable foe on just about everything that Senator Kennedy was fighting for. And yet McConnell spoke about a moment of, you know, Kennedy coming down and talking in Kentucky at his invitation and the gifts they'd exchanged and so forth. And, you know, there is a human dimension to the man that you don't capture at all with all of those partisan ads at election time.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the legislation. We know that he was working on a bill that would extend collective bargaining rights to police and firefighters. Another bill that would, you know, was going to overhaul education legislation. Are these? We hear that some at least are stalled before the memorial break, at least.
No, the other aspect to the senator that I think is undervalued outside the Senate is how important he is as a deal closer. He was a key player in just about anything social that the Bush administration achieved, from, you know, education to the attempted immigration reform.
He was a key architect. Right now, he was a key architect of No Child Left Behind. In other words, he's the guy who came in and was able to close the deals.
He was. He was. I remember sitting at the when the new education secretary was sworn in. Senator Kennedy was in the audience, and immediately after, he rushed up. He went over to President Bush, took his hands in both his hands, and he said, I really want to work with you. I really want to work with you on education. Really want to work with you on immigration. And he did.
Yeah. We know that there's a health care technology bill that's expected to also be put on hold.
Medicare health parity bill. There's, I think the major one that was on the floor last week is a bill to ensure that police and firefighters have the right to unionize. This is a classic Kennedy bill. And, you know, thundering from the floor about why these first responders deserve a right to unionize. That was held up with all kinds of amendments. Senator Kennedy is probably the best person to try to whittle them down and get the bill through, and it's not clear that he'll be there to do that. That's why that bill is, its future is currently uncertain.
There's also the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. This was a 13-year fight for Kennedy. President
That's
Bush
right.
was slated to sign into law today. So where does that stand?
I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. My expectation would be that the president would wait until Kennedy can be with him. I'm just not sure about it. But I think the key issue, even beyond the votes that he was personally involved in, Democrats have a big problem right now with both presidential contenders still out of the Senate, and several members with health problems, with basic close votes, you know, a budget that sets the terms for domestic spending, the war funding bill. It's these close votes where Kennedy's presence, if he's not able to come back, will be especially missed.
Not to mention a presidential campaign that he might help smooth into the final months that's coming up.
Yes.
But we rush to say he says he plans to be involved. What's the anticipation there?
There is no one that would count him out, that does count him out. He has managed at every stage of his political career, his public life, to kind of reinvent himself in a way that manages to stay relevant. I have no doubt that capacity will continue up until his last breath.
Christian Science Monitor Senior Congressional Correspondent Gail Chadwick checking in for us from Washington. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, when we come back, there may be no cure for cancer, but there is hope for the future, and two brothers are working on just that. We'll hear about that later in the program. Actress Karen Allen returns to the big screen in the new Indiana Jones movie, and her fans say, finally, back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with a story we had coincidentally planned for today. When it comes to cancer, of course, Ted Kennedy is only the latest, most visible patient. More than 40% of Americans will contract cancer in their lifetime. This despite nearly $80 billion in cancer research since President Nixon launched the war on cancer in 1971. But there is optimism for the future fight against cancer. That's because doctors, engineers, and computer scientists are now working together to solve the riddles posed by the disease. They're trying to develop tiny weapons small enough to target cancer cells and smart enough to spare healthy cells. They're called nanoparticles. How tiny? Well, they're millions of times smaller than a tennis ball. We spoke with two men who are on the front lines in this fight. Michael Sima is a scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's working to develop these tiny devices. We also spoke with Michael's brother, Dr. Robert Sima, a gastrointestinal surgeon at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. I asked Dr. Sima, what makes cancer so hard to beat?
It's unpredictable. It's not a simple one step, now it's cancer, we can turn that back. It's a very complex, ever-evolving, ever-changing type of disease, and one fix or one approach isn't going to address it. And I think that's what's important now, is we're changing the paradigm of how we do research. Traditionally, for the last 50 years, it had been doctors in the labs. Now, bringing engineers in, bringing other people in, I think that's why we're moving forward in the last 10 years more than we've done in the last 50 years.
Well, Michael Sima, again, a researcher at the Mass Institute of Technology, MIT. Tell us about the use of these nanoparticles and the new thinking about fighting cancer. Yeah.
Those are involved both in diagnostics and in therapies, or at least they're in the research phases of both of those. MRI contrast agents are agents that help the MRI detect cancer earlier. Those are actually made of nanoparticles.
Well, now let's remind ourselves. We've talked about these tiny, tiny and almost invisible to the eye particles. Describe them again. What are they, nanoparticles?
Well, in the case that I just mentioned, those are little pieces of iron oxide that are infused like you would get normal, an infusion of a drug, and they end up in the lymphatics, the lymph nodes of your body. And then in the MRI, they make the contrast in the MRI, you know, the difference between black and white, mm-hmm. much greater so that a doctor can see this accurately and at a high resolution, and you can see small lesions and that might be cancer.
And Dr. Sima Robert in Minnesota, how does that help you as a surgeon? If, for instance, you've got this new way of looking at cancer using these nanoparticles that shows you where the cancer is?
Well, really what it does for us is one of the most important roles in my job as a gastrointestinal oncologist is when I go in, I want to try and take out the tumor, but I also want to get the draining lymph nodes because that's what establishes whether or not a patient needs to get chemotherapy. If the tumor is confined to, let's say, the wall of the colon and there's no lymph nodes are involved, then we traditionally don't give chemotherapy. But if there are lymph nodes involved, then we give chemo and it's been shown to improve survival. I don't know which lymph nodes are there or not. And all I do is take a sort of a segment of the bowel. If I knew there were lymph nodes further away that were positive, then I would take those and then they would actually say, yes, you need chemo. But if I just happen to miss them, then some patients who would benefit from chemo won't get it.
Well, and also, would you at other points consider whether or not to even do surgery if, in fact, you realize, wait a second, surgery isn't going to get at the problem. There's a bigger problem beyond this area I was targeting.
Exactly. And more importantly, what I've been doing and all my colleagues are doing, we're basically doing the same operation that we've been doing for the last 150 years. The question is, with new technology, can we fundamentally change the operation so it's safer, more accurate, and better for the patient?
How are they helping, Michael, deliver medication?
Yeah, this is the newest area of cancer therapy where you can target therapeutic agents to cancer cells. And unfortunately, chemotherapeutics right now are mostly poisons. So you get a great deal of side effects associated
right.
with them.
It attacks everything in going after that cell.
In a word, yeah. And if we can attach the poison only to those cells through a little package we call a nanoparticle, then we can direct the poison only to those cells and not to the rest of your body.
And where is the work on this?
Targeting is very good. The issue is that there's a whole part of your body that's associated with removing particles, foreign matter from circulation.
Like the liver.
We have to hide these particles from those structures to prevent them ending up in places like liver, kidneys, and those sort of things.
And rejecting these little
right.
Stealth carriers.
Right. So the stealth part of that is part of the engineering that's going on now
right.
is to make them stealth to those parts of the anatomy, but still leave them sensitive enough to attach to cancer
yeah.
cells.
Robert, why is it that, for instance, AIDS is manageable, and yet cancer is not at that stage where, you know, if caught in time, the outcome would just be that it would be manageable as opposed to, you know, fatal?
I actually think of HIV as the paradigm for how we should address cancer. when President Nixon said, you know, we will eradicate cancer, it was because of they were thinking that it was this one-step disease process. You either have it or you don't, and there's a trigger, and we'll figure out the trigger.
I mean, the way we treated flu outbreaks, for instance.
Right, exactly. You know, when I was starting in medical school was when HIV was, you know, we didn't know what it was. And when we first found out, then people said, we'll cure it with immunization. We'll prevent it from happening. And that hasn't evolved as we thought it would. But what has was a different approach. We'll turn it into a chronic disease, and we'll manage it. And now you have Magic Johnson, people like that who are, you know, living very productive lives with 20 years of HIV. 20 years ago, it was a death sentence. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're doing with cancer now. It's a whole new paradigm. You know, we would love to cure it, but we're trying to switch it more towards how do we better manage this disease with new technology and new chemotherapeutics so that people can live productive lives with their disease.
That's Dr. Robert Sima, a gastrointestinal surgeon at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. We also spoke with his brother, Michael Sima. He's a researcher at MIT working on new tools to fight and detect cancer. Well, a quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, a breakthrough deal in Lebanon. It promises an end to street clashes and a political stalemate. But Hezbollah emerges the winner with veto power over any government decision. We'll find out what that is going to mean. Also, still to come in the days ahead, a new collection of sports writing from the late David Halberstam. And still ahead today, is it possible a typo in a computer program caused a top financial analyst to give top ratings to bad investments? That's still ahead after the news, Here and Now. As Americans slog through the housing crisis, they might wonder, how is it that analysts didn't see this coming? For instance, why did credit rating agencies such as Moody's and Standard & Poor's put their AAA stamp of approval on risky CPTOs, that's a type of bundled investment? Based on that AAA rating, investors quickly snapped up the CPTOs. Well, today, the Financial Times reports that Moody's awarded the high ratings by mistake, based on a computer glitch. Joining us from their radio studio in London is Sam Jones, the head writer on the FT story, which leads the newspaper today. And Sam, a computer glitch. Explain that. How is that possible?
Well, what we're talking about here is a typo, really. Moody's, just like every other rating agency, puts together very large and complicated mathematical codes, which they run and use the output from those to assess the likelihood of these bonds defaulting. Now, in this case, a pretty small typo in that code, in a great big sort of document, had a pretty big effect. And it meant that these products, CPDOs, should never have been given a AAA rating.
Well, now, when did people at Moody's realize this?
The evidence we've seen indicates early in 2007.
Did they change the code afterwards? Did they change the ratings?
It appears they corrected the code, but CPTOs issued after that correction still achieved AAA ratings.
Now, have you asked why that was?
Indeed, we have several times. Moody's haven't been clear with us on this, what appears to have happened is simultaneous to the code correction, two methodological changes were made, that is sort of changes which reflects Moody's assumptions about the market and the way it's going to behave in the future. And it seems that the effect of those methodological changes was that CPDOs rated after that code issue was corrected were still able to achieve AAA ratings.
Huh. Well, and by the way, did Moody's announce this, or is this something that you are announcing through your article and through your investigation?
This is something the Financial Times has uncovered. This isn't something that Moody's have announced.
Well, has this kind of thing ever happened before?
Well, I guess it's important to stress that coding errors do happen at rating agencies, but never in a way that's this severe, and they aren't really openly discussed. Usually, you know, small typos like these occur because we're talking about very, very complicated mathematical models here, and just like a typo might appear in a news article or something similar, so you might expect a typo to appear in these models. But, you know, it's never been this bad before.
Well, and it raises a question. Moody's can at least say that it gave this stamp of approval to risky investments that, you know, should have been downgraded. What is Standard & Poor's excuse? Because didn't they often give the same high rating to the same risky investments?
Indeed, they did. And with these products, Standard & Poor's also assigned AAA ratings. Now, Standard & Poor's have stood by those AAA ratings and said that their methodology is separate to Moody's, and that they believe they were correct in awarding these AAAs back when they were launched in late 2006.
But we know many of their shareholders disagree.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, whether or not Standard & Poor's have different methodology is to some extent beside the point, because many investors will require two ratings on a product before they go in to buy. So the Moody's rating was critical.
Let's just back up for a second. You know, why is this so important? We've said that this is the, you know, this is how investors make their decisions to spend money. These ratings really do attract people to a buy.
Sure they do. And that was the kind of incredible thing about these particular products when they were launched. Bankers at Wall Street said that these things, CPDOs, were the holy grail of structured finance, because somehow they had this apparently riskless profile, AAA rating. You know, that's the same as the US government has. And yet they were paying pretty high rates. So they were promising investors pretty good returns, sort of 10 times similar products, and yet were supposedly riskless.
And it's very complicated what these actually are. But how did the fact that people were, you know, began defaulting on mortgages, how does that tie in to investors buying up these bundled investments?
Well, as you say, it is pretty complicated, and these products aren't specifically mortgage investments. But I guess the important thing to understand is how that mortgage crisis, how those subprime mortgages and the loss of confidence in banks spread to the credit markets in general. That's when these products started to hit trouble. And I guess, you know, it is all traceable back to these subprime debt problems.
So as the economy began to falter under the weight of the subprime mortgage crisis and people, you know, not paying their mortgages and money starting to dry up, these investments also became worth less, but they were still getting high ratings.
Yes, that's true. I mean, with these products in particular, they were only downgraded. They only lost their AAAs in January this year. And by that time, on paper at least, you know, they'd lost a lot of money, these products. And we've heard of some investors selling these back for as little as 40 cents on the dollar, so taking a 60% loss on their investment. And in some other cases, these same products, investors have seen their investment wiped out altogether.
What does this admission on the part of Moody's do now going forward? I mean, are people going to trust the ratings?
Well, obviously, that's a difficult question to answer, and one that everyone's going to be asking. The kind of critical thing is the loss of confidence in the rating agencies and the loss of confidence in AAA ratings, I guess. You know, people have said to us that that's the kind of big casualty of the credit crisis. I mean, people just don't understand how to judge risk in the marketplace without kind of having those things as a guide. We're not talking about the rating agencies and the kind of role they've played in the rating of corporate debt. So there's you know, obviously rating agencies have a good track record in that goes back hundreds of years. What we're talking about here is the rating of structured debt products, you know, very complicated stuff, and the stuff that's at the center of this crisis. Now, it's unlikely that those products are going to disappear altogether in the future. Whether people will be so willing to trust the rating agencies, who knows? I mean, we're looking at a stricter regulatory environment. The international body which represents regulators is going to be delivering a report on the rating agencies next week. And I guess that will be the thing that kind of sets the tone for what's going to happen in the months and years to come.
That's Sam Jones, reporter for the Financial Times. Sam, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Well, as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on anything on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. or you can always give a call and leave a message. Gather your thoughts. The number is 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Still to come, Karen Allen and how she dropped her high-tech knitting when Steven Spielberg called. That's still to come. You're listening to Here and Now. Want to learn how to hack into your own cell phone, make your own furniture, and sell it on the internet? Well, there are highly active websites now that cater to do-it-yourselfers. An oil industrial building, an old, rather, industrial building in Brooklyn is home to two sites in this burgeoning community. John Kalish reports.
Once a month, there is a meetup at the Brooklyn office of Make Magazine. On one recent evening, a young man in a dark lab coat lectured on how to cut and join different types of pipe. Phil Tyrone is a senior editor at Make.
I think we're in probably a decade-long cycle of people really looking at the things around them and deciding that they would rather take something apart or reuse it and throw it away. I think people are starting to buy tools, and they're interested in learning things from other people because they just have stuff. Like, we all have probably too much stuff.
Make's website, makezine.com, and its video podcast offer ideas and how-tos for recycling everyday objects and materials. The Make podcast sometimes comes in the form of a PDF file with schematic drawings that show how to wire home electronics projects. A recent episode explained how to iron plastic grocery bags into sheets of plastic fabric thick enough to sew together as a messenger bag.
You take your opened up plastic bag, fold it once, and then fold it again. Voila, 8 layers of plastic. Take your wax paper, protect your ironing board, put the plastic on the wax paper, and then put another layer of wax paper on top of it to protect your iron. Let your iron heat up, and then you just run the iron over the wax paper. Keep your iron moving.
The woman with the iron is Anda Lewis Corey, who works at a website called Etsy that's located in the same building as Make. Before she got a job in Etsy's marketing department, she was selling her own applique products on Etsy.com.
I looked around the website, you know, tried to read the how-tos, took a couple pictures, tentatively put up some listings, and then didn't really check my email. And a week later, I noticed I had a sale. So I panicked, and then after the initial panic was over and I sent the buyer their item, I started listing things compulsively and making stuff all the time. I didn't want to do anything else at that point, so I just crafted my face off.
Many crafters and do-it-yourselfers out there have oodles of energy for making stuff. Last year, some 50 Etsy sellers earned $30,000 or more selling their wares on the website. They sold handmade furniture, jewelry, clothing, bags, and accessories in what could be considered a virtual flea market. One woman took in more than $100,000 selling artwork and dolls she made. Once a month, crafters gather at Etsy Labs, a spacious workroom in Etsy's Brooklyn headquarters. Karen Edelman makes decorative belts for women. She calls them necklaces for the waist.
I'm making a custom belt out of 3 layers of about inch-wide maroon lace that I'm hand-stitching together, and then I'm going to attach it to a piece of elastic. And when I go home, I'm going to put on the buckle from a pair of overalls and hand-stitch a couple of decorative buttons, and so it's going to go around the waist and attach with the buckle from overalls.
Edelman has a day job as a museum educator. Like other Etsy sellers, she's crafting in her spare time.
One of the great things about Etsy is that you can do it on a total part-time basis. A lot of people have made it their full-time jobs, but most people still do it after work on the weekends, and it's something that you can just keep working on little by little and keep putting things up on the site.
Edelman hasn't sold that much on Etsy. Another crafter who'd like to be selling more on the website is 83-year-old Abe Moskowitz, a retired salesman in Queens who makes clocks.
This clock is a billiard clock. It looks just like a billiard table. I think you'll agree. Everything is covered in the green felt. I made a little cue stick myself. You know, it's all glued in and it's not going to fall apart. And it goes up on the wall and actually looks like a billiard table, I think, right?
Moskowitz vows to continue making clocks even if he's losing money on the enterprise.
If I get an idea tomorrow for a clock, it's going to be made. Even if eventually they have to be thrown in the garbage, I have to make it. That's how good I feel when I make it. It's very satisfying.
And to find out more about the online do-it-yourself movement, go to our website, here-now.org. John Kalish produced our story in Brooklyn, New York. In 1 minute, Karen Allen, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A couple of notes from around the world. Edvard Munch's masterpiece, The Scream, goes back on display this week in Oslo, Norway, for the first time since it was stolen 4 years ago. But the painting, along with Madonna, another stolen and returned Munch's masterpiece, will show permanent damage. Despite extensive restoration, water damage appears on the lower left corner of The Scream, and scrapes are visible on both paintings. The Scream shows a waif-like figure screaming, or is she hearing a scream? It was a major influence on the Expressionist movement. Restoration experts at the Munch Museum now believe it was painted in 1910 rather than 1893. And this note, in a nod to our next story, archaeologists have uncovered another quarry in Israel which may have produced the rocks used to build the Western Wall and the Temple Mount. The Jerusalem Post reports this latest discovery is located about 2 kilometers from the old city of Jerusalem. The quarry was probably abandoned around the Roman period.
This ain't gonna be easy.
Not as easy as it used to be.
Well, sure, holding off dozens of Cold War-era Soviet troops, not to mention battling assorted raised-from-the-dead indigenous peoples and snakes, don't forget the snakes, probably isn't as easy at 60-something as it is at 20-something. And those are just some of the challenges Indiana Jones faces in the highly anticipated Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which debuts in many theaters tonight at the stroke of midnight. Harrison Ford reprises his role as Indy. Steven Spielberg directs from a story by George Lucas. But what had fans talking at the preview we saw was the return of Karen Allen, who played Marion Ravenwood, the professor's daughter and Indy's feisty romantic interest in the first film, 1981's Raiders of the Lost Ark. Who can forget their first scene when Indy tracks down Marion in a bar in Nepal?
Indiana Jones. Always knew someday you'd come walking back through my door. I never doubted that. Something made it inevitable. So what are you doing here in Nepal?
I need one of the pieces your father collected.
Ouch. Well, now, 27 years later, Karen Allen is back, still packing a punch and a punchline. Her Marion, now in her mid-50s and a single mom. And Karen joins us with more from New York. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much.
Well, you know, we know you've done theater, other films, of course, Starman with Jeff Bridges, Scrooge with Bill Murray, you know, since the first Indy film. But this is Indy, so what was your reaction when they asked you to come back?
Oh, I was so thrilled. I was so delighted. Steven called me on the phone, Steven Spielberg, and said that they had a script that everybody was happy with and that they had written a wonderful role for me in the film and that he wanted me to come into New York and sit down and read the script.
Did you at all worry about your age and the expectation of audiences? You look great, I hasten to say, but you're not 20-something either, you know? And, you know, Harrison Ford had said that he insisted that his age be acknowledged. How'd you feel about that going in?
I don't have a problem with being my age. I'm actually having the time of my life in my 50s, and, you know, I'm proud of every little wrinkle and freckle I have. I don't know. I don't really subscribe to that sort of feeling that you have to continue to try and look 35 for the rest of your life. It really doesn't even interest me.
Well, you know, that's what we observed while watching. It looked like you weren't trying to look anything but who you are, and it was actually it was quite nice to see.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well, we can't let our listeners hear that more mature relationship between you and Indy because Paramount Pictures hasn't released any clips. We were told at the screening that this was a high-security film. We'd be escorted out if we even took out our cell phones. But we have a clip from the first film, Raiders of the Lost Ark. This is when Indy and Marion are captured by bad guys. They're trapped with a lot of snakes. Indy, of course, has a phobia of snakes. But that doesn't prevent you guys from continuing your sniping. Let's listen.
Indy!
Jesus! What'd
you get this? From him?
I was trying to escape. No thanks to you.
How hard were you trying?
Well, where the hell were you?
Watch it, watch it.
What are you doing?
Fire!
How the hell are we going to get out of here?
I'm working on it, I'm working on it.
Well, whatever you're doing, do it faster!
What was it like being with Harrison Ford again and reprising that relationship? Did you fall right back into it?
Just from the very first moment, we got together to do like some camera tests, and we just, you know, just saying that we were so excited to be, you know, working together again. And then on our very first day of shooting, we just dove right in, and we were doing a little action sequence in a truck barreling down a road and throwing ourselves from the back of the truck into the front of the truck and banging our elbows on hard metal objects and laughing and going, ow, and, you know, it felt really seamless.
You've talked probably ad nauseum about how you and Steven Spielberg were not on the same wavelength during making the first film. You're a trained actor. He was doing an action and special effects film. What about this time around?
Well, you know, it's true. I was just a little bit of a fish out of water in the first film. I didn't quite understand this genre. And, I was constantly trying to figure out what I was doing. And he knew very well what he was doing. And so I just had to kind of learn by the seat of my pants. I think this time around, it was just so much easier. I mean, you get to start kind of with all that familiarity. Right. You've kind of already gone through that process of learning, you know, how they think and what they want.
Well, I mentioned that, of course, you've made other films. You've been doing Shakespeare in Western Massachusetts in the Berkshires, where you also live and have a gorgeous knitting company. We've been online at your website. It's Karen Allen Fiber Arts. It's a designer knitting company. You know, beautiful stuff. And I didn't know that you had studied at the Fashion Institute when you were young and went back to study machine knitting.
Yeah.
What's the passion here?
Well, you know, it's a passion that goes way back to my childhood. My grandmother, who I adored, was a big-time knitter, taught me to knit when I was just a child. I knit through my entire, you know, growing up period, hand knit. And then I went to FIT, the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York, to study design. And then my life kind of went off in a different direction, and I ended up working in the theater and starting to do films. But I always continued to design and knit, and I always thought in the back of my mind, at some point, you know, my career will kind of slow down a little, as it does when you get into your 40s and then your 50s. And also I was raising a son on my own, and I didn't want to do the traveling involved in, you know, making films because it was so disruptive to his life when he was in school. And so I just went ahead and dove in and started this company, and I've just had such a wonderful time doing it. It's a passion of mine. I love ancient textiles. I've studied them my whole life, and so I work with a lot of beautiful geometric designs and color. And it's all in cashmere yarns that I get from Scotland and Italy. And it's something I absolutely adore doing.
Well, it's so funny because we're thinking, you know, the patterns are based on these ancient and modern textiles from around the world, but very Peruvian looking in some way, if I can describe them for radio. And there you are, a single mom raising a son. How Marion Ravenwood of you.
Yes, I suppose so.
Karen Allen, reprising her role as Marion Ravenwood in the new Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. Karen, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much.